morning. The next case on our calendar for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Campos. While you are getting settled, I'll just remind you of some of our rules. There aren't many of them. You each get 15 minutes for oral argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal in addition to that. The timing is indicated in the lights at the podium, and the podium can be raised or lowered to meet your needs. And it's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because we are recording that proceedings today. So just take a minute to get yourself settled.
Thank you.
I know about rushing into a courtroom, so please take your time, and then when you're ready, counsel for appellant, we are ready.
Please to court.
Yep.
Good morning, counsel. My name is Jim McGeaney. I'm the attorney for the appellant in this matter, Midwest Bonding LLC, appealing the denial of a bail bond reinstatement petition by the district court in the State of Minnesota versus Heriberto Campos criminal case. Your Honors, the crux of this case, it boils down to the denial of a petition that had previously been granted by another district court judge. So my client, we filed a petition to reinstate and discharge the bail bond in this case. That petition was granted by the district court. On the same day, respondent's trial attorney wrote a letter to the district court objecting to the petition. A different district court judge then vacated that prior order and set the matter on for a hearing, which was held about 3 months later. After the hearing, the district court found that basically it was a bad faith attempt by the defendant in posting the bond, and that the defendant's sole purpose in posting the bond was to avoid prosecution and facilitate his return to Mexico. And of course, then the district court imputed that bad faith on my client and denied the petition. The problem, the error with the district court, or the abuse of discretion with the district court, is that the district court based its conclusions on speculation and not evidence. So the district court's conclusion that Mr. Campos' sole purpose of posting the bond was to avoid prosecution is merely speculative and based entirely on what was argument of the assistant county attorney at Mr. Campos' bail hearing at his Rule 8 appearance. The state argued at the bail hearing that the court should, what happened was Mr. Campos originally had a bail bond posted. The state learned that he had then been subject to immigration proceedings and was in custody of the Immigration Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and brought a motion to review his conditions of release, writted him back to the county, the district court, and asked the court to revoke the conditional bail and set unconditional bail only, which the district court did at that hearing.
So it was the record, publicly available record, would have been that there had been a habeas writ because of Mr. Campos being held by some other jurisdiction,
yes,
for some other reason. So your client knew that.
Well, whether my client knew it or not is unknown, but
well,
it was,
I
available.
Mean, it's publicly available.
Yes.
So wouldn't that have tipped Midwest Bonding out to the fact that I should at least inquire as to what other jurisdiction had
it should have
of Mr. Campos?
Certainly. But there was nothing in that public record. The only thing that would point to the bond company is that Mr. Campos was in custody in another jurisdiction. That didn't necessarily tip the bond, as the court said, tip him off, or I think the trial court said, make known that there were removal proceedings pending and that a removal order had already been issued. That was the finding by the district court, that it was a public record or available in the public record that removal proceedings had been initiated and that there were three findings, basically. Removal proceedings had been initiated, that Mr. Campos had asked the immigration judge to remove him from the country, and that the immigration judge had issued a removal order.
Would you agree that the public record included information that would put a bond company on notice that he may be subject to deportation?
No, I would not. Just because someone is in the custody of the immigration courts does not necessarily mean that they're subject to deportation. It just means that their status in the United States is in question. But those proceedings could last for years. It doesn't follow exactly that they're going to be removed. It just means that they're in custody of the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency because their status is in question.
I guess when I look at the first factor in the district court's analysis on, you know, the purpose of bail, I mean, I understand your argument about your concern that the court relied upon Mr. Campos's request for removal from the country, which came in through argument of the prosecutor. I mean, I get that. But the court does also talk about, you know, quite a bit that the public record should have alerted the bonding company that this was an issue. And I guess so why wouldn't that be enough for us to affirm the district court decision, particularly since, and maybe this isn't relevant, you can give me your take, the other bond companies, I read it, you know, followed up or talked to the client and said, no, we're not going to post another $75,000 bond, which is why, as I understand it, they came to your client.
Well, one thing is, what the district court cites as the public record is not the public record. For instance, the court minutes that the district court cites, they're not available in the public record. There is no document that's available in the Minsis record that's minutes from the court proceedings.
I understand, but there was other information in the court record that at least might have put someone on notice.
Merely the writ, I would say. The writ and the motion from the district court. Yeah. But that, again, all that really notices a potential bond company is that this defendant's up in the Sherburne County Jail and is being brought to Olmsted County Jail for his appearance. It doesn't put the bond company on notice that there's a removal proceeding that's been initiated. And by the way, interestingly, from the date that the respondent objected to the initial grant of the petition by the district court, so the initial petition was granted, the respondent objected to that, had a hearing set. The hearing wasn't held for over 90 days, plenty of time to procure any removal order, if there was one, any transcript of a proceeding in the immigration courts, if that's in fact what happened, if Mr. Campos actually did say, hey, send me back to Mexico. But they didn't. So the respondent objects to the order, asks for a hearing, and then does nothing to buttress their argument that, hey, and in the objection from the respondent in the district court, they said, we object because appellant knew or should have known there was a removal order and that the defendant, Mr. Campos, asked to be removed, but presented nothing, even though they had 3 months to obtain evidence of that, presented nothing in the district court to back that up. And the record that's available doesn't have any of that information. The record that's available is a writ and a motion from the respondent's attorney.
And maybe some of what you just said helps answer this question, but could you tell me, and I understand this case isn't precedent for us, but I was looking at the Commonwealth versus Batista case from the Supreme Court in Massachusetts. So how is this different than that case? Because we have a lot of the same issues, it appears to me, going on.
Is that a case cited by a respondent?
Maybe I was just doing too much.
I'm not familiar with
that
case, Your Honor.
Then just move on.
Okay, sure.
It's certainly not precedent to this court.
I think this case would be more in line with the case cited by the district court in its order, the Ide case, where the Minnesota courts have discussed that it was actually State versus Due is a case where this court, it's from 1988, where a panel of this court suggested anyway, it's not a holding in the case, but in dicta, it suggests that if it's actions by the government that make it impossible for the bail bond company to perform on their agreement, then that's good cause to discharge the bail bond. And here, really, it's the actions of the immigration enforcement agency that makes it impossible to procure, or almost impossible to procure Mr. Campos, at least impossible for Midwest bonding.
Mr. McGinney, that you've hit on a question I wanted to inquire of you, and that's the role of the reason, I should say, of abandonment or not being present at the hearing. And I'm looking at a quote from the Shetsky case, and I wanted to get your thought to this, since that's the one we follow in all these, and the Shetsky factors, that still seems to be the case that we refer to. And on page, I believe it's 472, at the outset, we have the question of whether there was a willful default. A willful default under a bail bond means the willful default of the principal, the defendant, and not the surety. And I wanted to get your thought on what that means as it applies to, and is that the point you were getting into, that our traditional situation, of course, is obviously just absconding from everybody just now wanting to come to court. That's the standard. Now, here, it seems like everybody knew why he was not present at the omnibus hearing. Do you believe that's a willful default? And if so, or if not, is that the error you're referring to that the court made in its findings and conclusion as it applies to those Shetsky factors?
That's a good question. I'm glad to answer that, Your Honor. No, it's not willful by Mr. Campos because he can't control where he is. That's the error in the district court's reasoning. The district court finds, hey, Mr. Campos orchestrated this whole thing. He went to immigration court, he said removing from the country, and then he procured a bail bond to accomplish that. We don't know that that's what happened. Everybody presumes that's what happened because Mr. Woodford told the court that's what was going on, and the court took his argument at face value. But here, you can't rely on what Mr. Woodford said in the bail hearing as evidence. Again, there was 90 days to produce evidence that that's the chain of events. If there's evidence that that's the chain of events, then maybe, yes, it's willful, but there's no evidence that that's actually what happened. In this case, the Shetsky case and its progeny say being in custody in another agency's custody is good reason to miss court. That's a good excuse. And here, Mr. Campos is in the custody of the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency when he doesn't come to his hearing.
So is it your understanding or belief there's nothing in the record that would indicate a desire on the defendant's part to purchase the bond in order to be deported other than the end result that that's what happened?
Exactly. Yes, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record to support that finding that the district court made, that that was the intent of Mr. Campos in buying that bond. It's, and that finding, you got to track back. Again, it's based on the representation that was made in the bail argument by the respondent's trial attorney at that time. But as in, if you've all been a district court judge in a criminal proceeding, there's lots of statements made at a Rule 6 hearing. You know, when you're trying to argue about a defendant's bail, that doesn't need to be backed by evidence. It's argument made on the fly. But this is not a bail hearing. This is a civil proceeding, and the rules of civil procedure apply, and the respondent had ample opportunity to present evidence to support their argument, and they haven't. So it's error for the district court to make that finding that's unsupported by the evidence. And I think that's where you're going. So if they had evidence, if they produced a transcript from the immigration hearing where Mr. Campos said, I want to go back to Mexico, please deport me, and then they produced a order from an immigration judge removing Mr. Campos from the country, then it would be a reasonable inference that the district court could have made that, yes, now he's acting in bad faith. But that's not the case here. There's no evidence in the record that that's what happened. It's merely a conclusion that the district court made based on the arguments that were made by counsel, which are not evidence.
So, Mr. McGinney, you've done a lot more of these cases than I've been on the panel for, so let me ask you, what is the best case to talk about the level of evidence that's required at a bail hearing? Because I must say, just in the transcripts I've read of these different requests for reinstatement, I've seen district judges rely upon what's told to them by attorneys, including sometimes by you, in making their findings. So where will we turn to best see
this?
Well,
in a reinstatement hearing, the evidence is the affidavits that have been produced. We've produced an affidavit. It's unrefuted. It's occasional testimony when we have a bail hearing that it's going to be questioned about what efforts they made because, you know, just the efforts made by a fugitive recovery agent, for instance. He'll come and testify at the hearing. I knocked on doors. I did this, that, and the other thing to try to find the defendant. In a bail hearing in a criminal case, I don't know if there's any evidentiary burden. But in a civil case, like a bail bond reinstatement, as Shesky says, this is a civil proceeding, then the evidence could be affidavits, exhibits. Respondent had plenty of opportunity, again, to produce any of those things, and none were produced. So I think basically in these kinds of cases, it's affidavits and exhibits in 99% of these cases. Occasionally, we call witnesses at those hearings. I don't know that I've appealed a hearing. I don't know if I had to appeal a hearing where we've actually had an evidentiary hearing on a bail bond reinstatement. They haven't come up on appeal. I know I get occasionally beat up by panels because the records are skinny. That's the words that a panel member has used to me, skinny record. And here, it is a skinny record, but it's skinny against respondent. And they had the opportunity to create a record. And Mr. Woodford, if you read the transcript multiple times, says, you know, I'm not really, this isn't really my area. I don't do a lot of this work. But that's not an excuse to not put evidence into the record to support the argument that you're going to make. And that's not what didn't happen here. So we're respectfully asking this court to reverse the trial court in order the bond be reinstated and discharged. And I'll reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Plant. I'm here on behalf of the state of Minnesota today, also the county of Olmsted, since it is, of course, a civil proceeding. So I just want to be clear as to who my actual employer and client are. Today I'm asking you to find that Judge King properly exercised her discretion when she declined the appellant's request to have the bond reinstated. Mr. McGeaney mentioned that the record is skinny, so I'm just going to start from there. The record is skinny, but the fact that the state didn't produce evidence at that hearing doesn't obviate the need for the appellant to satisfy his burden, either in the district court or here in the Court of Appeals before you today. The record is skinny because the appellant simply failed to demonstrate to the district court's satisfaction that, in fact, it had satisfied the 3 out of the 4 Shetsky factors for which it was responsible. The state was required to show that it suffered prejudice as a result of the failure of the defendant to appear, and the general rule in such a case when the defendant does fail to appear, and in fact, absconds from the country, or at least the jurisdiction, is that the bond should not be reinstated and should remain forfeited because the prejudice is obvious. The state no longer can hold that person accountable if he needs to be held accountable, and the administration of justice is stymied.
This is my fundamental problem with this case. It seems to be the only party surprised by what happened in this case is the bail bond company.
That's correct.
Clearly, the state was in the courtroom on June 8th. The district court, everybody knew that deportation was a real possibility. And yet, despite that, the district court set conditional bail. The state asked for it to be set. And before the bonding company could do anything except, I guess, honor what the district court provided, and that is Mr. Campos, a right to obtain conditional release, before Midwest Bonding does anything, they've waived all their rights and they forfeit the bond. It just doesn't strike me as fair. Why am I wrong?
With respect to Midwest Bonding, what you phrased as waiving any rights, is that the question? I want to make sure
I'm understanding. No, I'm just saying, how is it fair? That Midwest Bonding did nothing except honor what the district court order said, and that is extending conditional release, because that's what the district court directed. The bonding company did that.
Right.
And then before anyone knew it, Mr. Campos was deported. And I don't think anyone is claiming that Midwest Bonding did anything wrong, but it just strikes me that whether you're applying the Shetsky factors or some other fairness argument, I just don't understand why forfeiting the bond is a fair outcome.
Well, it is a fair outcome, and I'll tell you why. First of all, with respect to what Midwest Bonding is supposed to do, they're entering into a contract. As Mr. McGeaney noted, this is a civil proceeding. Why? Because it's rooted in contract law. Midwest Bonding is entering into a contract with Mr. Campos and also to a certain extent with the court, saying that it's going to secure the defendant's appearance at a criminal proceeding, and that if it's willing to take the risk that if the defendant fails to appear at that hearing, it's going to forfeit a significant amount of money for not doing its due diligence in ensuring his appearance. So what the order really focuses on, if you look carefully at it, is the issue of risk assessment. And what was the expectation of Midwest Bonding or any other bond company that would enter into this type of contractual relationship with a criminal defendant, and as I mentioned, sort of the court as an interested party? And the relationship is one of risk assessment. And Judge King goes into that in her order, where she talks about, first of all, they could have or should have known that this was a person who already was in danger of not appearing for court. Let's put it that way. No one, although immigration is part of the facts in this case, it's the red herring to the extent that no one, including Mr. Woodford in the district court, was imposing an obligation on Midwest Bonding to ascertain Mr. Campos's immigration status, when he was going to be deported, or anything like that. What the district court faulted the appellant for failing to do here was failing to assess the risk involved with posting a bond for an individual that was highly unlikely under this set of facts to appear for court. And as far as the fairness goes, just back to your question, Judge Bjorkman, before I move too far astray from it, there's other information in the record with respect to what the court was considering, because it's not just what evidence was before the court at the civil hearing, it's what evidence was in the record. And what was in the record was information from Mr. Campos's district court defense attorney, who actually was present at the immigration hearing and verified to the judge, yes, proceedings had been commenced. I, in fact, was at the hearing. I can't tell you everything that went on because that's not my area of expertise. It's a complicated area of law. I'm not willing to concede anything except the fact that I was there and the fact that the judge ordered that removal occur.
And this was at the June 5th?
That was at the June 5th hearing. And those were statements made by Mr. Cashins to the court when she was inquiring as to, I don't understand, what's the need for bail? And actually, Judge Wallace goes into this sort of monologue in response to Mr. Woodford's request for bail and essentially says, well, I don't know if it matters whether I issue a bail order or not, because I don't know that the federal government is going to defer to a district court. I've had people who are sitting on a district court hold order in the Olmsted County Jail be picked up by Immigration Services, removed, and sent home. So these are all factors, actually, that the district court, first Judge Wallace and then Judge King, were assessing with respect to the risk that a contractual party was assuming. Yes, Judge Slater.
And risk is interesting because I follow up with Judge Barkman's point. I'm assuming it's undisputed that the best information the judge had in terms of risk of failing to appear was the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney at the time. And my question is this, and I'm looking at the writ, and this kind of gets to the point you were making in that additional comment that the judge made. The writ required the state or asked the federal government to release him for purposes of this hearing, and it's the writ for the hearing where he did ultimately show up and the bail was increased.
Yes.
And then on the second page of the writ, it goes on to say, and that said authority shall assume full responsibility of such custody and shall return the said, and names the appellant, to the custody of Peter Berg, Field Officer, Director of Immigration at Fort Snelling. So my question is this: what evidence in the record does posting a bond or not posting bond would have changed the result, meaning that he would have been deported, because the obligation by that writ was to return him to Fort Snelling, so let's presume no bond is posted, he's returned to Fort Snelling and then deported. The question I have, how does all of that, if there is no evidence in the record of that, how then the reverse of that support the court's finding that he posted bail in order to be deported? The point being is it looks like from the record he may have been, as far as we know, deported one way or the other. And everybody except the bail bond knew that.
Well, I would beg to differ on that point, Your Honor, to the extent that the record is silent other than the affidavit filed by appellant as to what the bond company actually did or didn't know. So let's go back for a second to the burden at this civil proceeding, which is that the appellant is obligated to show why it is that the bond should be reinstated. And while the bond company may sort of dodge the issue here in his affidavit, which, yes, becomes evidence at the civil proceeding, again, that doesn't mean that he gets to sit idly by and not fully fulfill his burden to produce evidence, for one, and two, persuade the district court that the bond should, in fact, be reinstated. And in order to do that, the court needs to look at more than just whether or not the defendant's going to appear. It does look at the purpose of the bail proceedings. Judge, you look like you have another question.
Well, I'm assuming then you've kind of jumped to that, and that was a question I asked of counsel, too, from the Shetsky factor. Do you see a distinction? By the way, I assume there's nothing in the record that tells us whether he would have been deported regardless of the bail being posted.
Well, he would have been deported. That much is clear in my mind.
Regardless of
based
the bail.
On the representations of Mr. Cashins, who is defense counsel in the district court, as well as the representations of Mr. Woodford, who is the attorney for the state, yes, everyone was under the impression, including the man who sat in the deportation hearing, that there was an order.
Accepted the prosecutor's request to increase the bail. They were comfortable with the risk that he may still be deported, whether you post bail or not.
Was the judge comfortable with that? Was that the question?
What I'm getting at is that was the whole reason we had this hearing,
to review
the bail, because he was being held and there was a request for an additional $150,000 unconditional and a $75,000 conditional. Or I said it backwards. No, I said it correctly, I think. The point being is that he was going to, the risk was that everybody in the courtroom knew he was not going to be back for trial regardless. Unrelated to posting
sure.
bail.
Sure, I understand what you're saying, absolutely, and I'm sorry if I kind of cut you off there. I think we're okay. A little bit off with our timing today.
I don't know. In other words, the record does not indicate whether posting bail or not would have had an effect on deportation.
It's not clear, to be honest with you, and the tricky part about this is that none of us in this room, I'm assuming, are immigration law experts, but the district court does make a point of that. Again, I mentioned she seemed to be somewhat confused, and I really don't she said, I don't really understand, state, why you've brought this motion. And then Judge King actually also touches on it at the December 20th hearing, where she talks about the fact that, well, in this state, we have, you know, all criminal defendants have the right to, you know, conditional bail as well as unconditional bail. I can't speak for that. That is not my wheelhouse. I know almost nothing about bail hearings, and I don't believe that to be the issue here before the court today. What I do believe the issue is that Midwest Bonding had enough information available to it at the time, and I'm going to go back to this because there's not really a lot of case law on this particular issue either with respect to bond forfeiture and reinstatement, is that they are entering into a contract for a not insignificant sum of money, to the tune, in this particular case, of $75,000. Now, with respect to your question, Judge Sleater, maybe they thought that he no longer had that much money sitting around. That's a pretty high bail, at least for Olmsted County. It's not something that most people are able to come up with the 10% to post, even, and he already had done so. So I don't know that anyone anticipated that he was going to be able to post a bond in that case. But again, that's speculation. What I'd really like to focus on here is the idea that this is a surety contract, and that entering into a contract, just like it would be if you were going to buy a car, is all about the assessment of risk. What are you willing to sort of give up? What's your consideration in exchange for what you want, and what is the other party willing to give you in consideration? Now, in the contract here, Midwest Bonding said, I'm willing to assume the risk of the possibility that you're going to get deported, which is in the record that he's going to be deported at some point, whenever it's going to happen.
And it's in the record in what form? In the
writ
itself?
It's in the record with respect to a register of actions. If you want to look at that, you can see Mr. Woodford's motion. You can see that the writ was issued. You could have sat in the hearing, and I do want to touch on that briefly because Judge King actually even mentions, and I can attest to this as well, and as can Mr. McGinney, that these bail bondsmen are routinely in the courthouse in Olmsted County. They're routinely sitting in hearings at bail hearings, listening to what's going on, because that is one of the ways that they get business. Yes, Judge Jessen.
Ms. Plant, I understand your risk assessment argument and that there is support in the record for that, but that's only one of two reasons that the court kind of did the assessment it did on the first Chesky factor.
Sure.
And the other was that Mr. Campos's non-appearance was caused by his request for removal from the country.
Yes.
Is there evidentiary support in the record for that finding? And if not, don't we have to remand for a reassessment of the Chesky factors?
No, I don't believe you do, because we're talking about an abuse of discretion, which
but
is a deferential standard.
Would you agree that there's not evidence to support that sentence in the district court's order?
With respect to the point on, I'm sorry, Judge,
that
with
Mr.
respect
Campos,
to...
Mr. Campos' non-appearance was caused by his request for removal from the country.
That is based on the argument of counsel as far as I can ascertain from the record, but no one Chesky factor is dispositive. It's a balancing test among the three, and the question is whether, again, appellant met his burden, not whether the state met its burden, and whether the district court's order was based on an erroneous view of law. We're not even talking about an order here that's inconsistent with the facts in the record. When you look at the cases, which is typical of criminal appeals, when you look at the cases for these civil appeals of bond forfeitures, the only thing you're looking at with an abuse of discretion is an erroneous view of the law. Judge King applied the proper view of the law. She applied the Chesky factors. She looked at the purposes of bail, which is to make sure that the defendant appears for court. And I'm almost out of time, but I would encourage you to revisit the Rodriguez case, which came down in 2009, because you can't really, with how thin the case law is in this area, you really can't get facts much better than that. Very similar, that was a defendant who was living in the Texas area or was well established and had roots in the Texas area, was likely to either stay in Texas or go over the border to Mexico, back to where he had other roots. And the court said, no, you're entering into a contract for $50,000. You need to do more. Your extraordinary efforts, A, weren't extraordinary, and B, were only necessary because you didn't do the appropriate assessment of risk before you entered into that contract. And barring any further questions, the state will rest. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal, 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just start briefly with distinguishing Rodriguez. Rodriguez is not a case where the defendant failed to appear because of actions by the government. This case before Your Honors is a case where Mr. Campos is not here because of actions by the government. And so that's distinguishable. Interestingly, you talk about fairness, Your Honor. The previously posted $75,000 bail bond was discharged. And yet that bond company at the June 5th hearing didn't come and ask to be reinstated and discharged after they had learned about the immigration status. They didn't file a petition to reinstate and discharge until after Mr. Campos failed to appear for his omnibus hearing. And so both petitions were before the district court. The district court granted one and denied one. Ours wasn't before the court yet. So how fair is that? Their bond is reinstated and discharged, and ours isn't. Risk assessment isn't the test here. There's always risk in posting bail bonds. The risk is that the defendant's not going to appear. But the risk isn't that the defendant might be deported. You have to have some kind of understanding that's out there. And
why doesn't the writ itself, which directs the district court to return Mr. Campos to federal custody, why isn't that enough notice to the bonding company?
Because it doesn't talk about deportation proceedings being initiated, and it doesn't mention that there's a deportation order already been signed, which were the aversions made at the bail hearing. And I think Your Honor's right. I mean, that part of the record seems to indicate that it wouldn't matter whether or not Midwest posted the bond or not, that Mr. Campos was never coming back, because that writ directed them to return Mr. Campos after that hearing back to Fort Snelling. So what do we have here?
Midwest bonding should have passed, right?
If they had known that Mr. Campos was going back to Fort Snelling, but there's nothing in the record to say Midwest actually saw the writ or saw the motion. And there's nothing in the record to show that Midwest was at the hearing, by the way. In fact, I asked the district court in this hearing, is there anything in the record to say Midwest was here? And there wasn't. So the, you know, when counsel tells Your Honor that there's evidence in the record, there's not. There's no transcript of that hearing in the record. And what was said in that hearing and recorded in the minutes of that hearing is not publicly available. It's the court record, not available to the appellant. So what we have here really is a case where Midwest is being punished, right? They're being punished because, according to the district court, they didn't do their due diligence in figuring out that Campos was going to be subject to removal, already was. And Chesky talks about the purpose of bail is not to punish sureties. And what the state is saying here is, hey, we want the $75,000 that you promised to pay because Mr. Campos was removed. And again, Chesky and the cases after talk about the fact the purpose of bail is not to increase the revenue of the state. The reason Mr. Campos is not available for prosecution is because the United States government removed him from this country. That's why he's not here. And to punish Midwest and cause them to put $75,000 into the state's coffers because they didn't assess that risk is not, it's not fair, for one, and it's not in the scheme of bail bond law. Midwest did what the district court did. They came and said, okay, we'll post the other $75,000 of the $150,000 unconditional bond that the district court set. Grandy Bail Bonds had posted the other half. Grandy Bail Bonds petition and was granted and it was discharged, even though they knew on June 5th, it's in their petition of discharge, that they knew back at the bail hearing that Mr. Campos was subject to some kind of immigration status. By the way, Grandy's petition doesn't say they knew he was subject to a removal order or that he had asked to be removed from the country. So the record doesn't support those. The fact that the bail bond company could have sat in that hearing is irrelevant. That's not before this court. And I think that's all I wanted to address, again. And I think Your Honor's right. You know, Midwest posted that bond in good faith. They made efforts to try to make sure that Mr. Campos was found after he failed to appear for court. The case law from this court is clear. There's no pre-hearing requirement. There's no requirement for a bail bond company to affirmatively ensure that a defendant appears for their hearing. It's after the failure to appear that they are required to take efforts, and they did. So we respectfully ask you to reverse the decision and not remand. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you both for your helpful arguments. The case was well presented. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. And that is the last case on our calendar for oral arguments, so we will recess. All rise.